Yes, welcome back to the No State Project. I'm your host, Mark Stevens, author of Government Indicted. And Tom was not the one who brought up ethics and meat, you know, and veganism. That was me, because I started off the show talking about ethics and morals. And it just seems to be going that way because, hey, the principle of do no harm is consistent with the theme of the show. Why do we want to get rid of this concept of government? Because it causes unspeakable harm. And I didn't mean that everyone was insane who wasn't a vegan. Not that anyone mentioned that, but what I'm saying is if our moral principle or ethic is to do no harm, that if we do unnecessary harm and killing, then we're acting unethically. That's what I mean by that. And I don't see where that's in, you know, where there's an inconsistency or where there's in the logic there or look, if the principle is do no harm, then it logically follows that unnecessary harm and killing violates that principle and is not ethical or moral. And bottom line, that's what it is. The unnecessary, you know, injury and death on another being that's sentient, that can suffer, is wrong, period. And that's the reason why people get upset when we talk about veganism. It's the same reason, because it's the same reason why someone who loves government and thinks it should be, what about my roads? The same thing with veganism. What about my bacon? What about my proteins? The same reason why the statists get pissed off when we show how immoral their belief is or their actions are. It's the same thing we get when we talk about veganism. Because if we're talking about the same principle, it's just a different inconsistency with the principle of do no harm. So, to not do any further harm, let's bring, he's been on the show before, Corey from EIB. Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Hey, Mark, it's Corey Ibe. The family name is EIB, and the podcast that I co-host is the Agenda 31 podcast with Todd McGreevy. EIB is that guy with the golden microphone, and, you know, he's a Republican supporter, which I get confused with a whole bunch because of the name, especially at restaurants.
But, you know, the guy, I heard him about 5 or 6 years ago, maybe a little more, saying he was done carrying the water for the Republican Party. So you're telling me that even though I haven't listened to him in all those years, he wasn't consistent with that, he still carries the water for the Republican Party?
Well, maybe I misspoke. I appreciate you saying that because I quit listening to him more than 5 years ago. So when I last listened to him, he was carrying the water for the Republican Party. So if he's no longer doing that, then I stand corrected for sure.
It reminds me of what some other Republican had mentioned, and you can Google it. What was his name? Oh, Sean Hannity. He said, "Sir, I'm not a Republican. I'm a registered conservative." I'm like, I don't think that's an actual party.
Yeah, I'm not aware that you could register conservative. That's not something I've heard of.
Well, hey, far be it from somebody on Fox News to get the facts right.
Far be it from any of the news organizations to get the facts right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's registered as a conservative to vote, not as a registered. Okay, we got to get on. I can't spend any more airtime on these guys.
Good. I didn't mean to hijack it that way.
No, I brought it up. I mentioned it.
So, you know, Mark, I'm calling. First off, I want to say I think we actually agree on way more than anything we disagree on. And you've brought up a few times about there being no evidence of a state. And I thought maybe I could call in and show you my pitch. First off, let me say we both agree that the people that occupy the governments of, you know, like Arizona, the case where the building permits over a greenhouse, you know, those people that operate that government.
Yeah.
We are both aligned in putting them back in their box. In other words, keeping them out of our lives. You and I are 100% aligned on that. Where I think we differ on beliefs is whether or not a state exists. And I was just calling to see if maybe I could, you know, throw out my two cents on why I think that no matter what you have, whether or not these people are in office or not, or anything, even if this entire government that we have today were to just simply dissolve, that there naturally occurs a state when you have a group of people living within an area. I find the your position as an anarchist very fascinating, because I really don't think I understood anarchy very well prior to, you know, listening to your broadcasts and how you approach legal things. So if I'm wrong on your position, please correct me.
Well, from what you've said, I don't think you've got it wrong. I'm just intrigued as to, you must be using the word definition, you know, defining state different, because it may not be a definition I'm familiar with, because just people, because basically what you're saying is, in a sense, just people living in a certain area are a state, instead of just being a community.
I think I would word it a little bit different. I would say people, you know, a group of people living in an area is where a state develops. It doesn't mean that they are a state. It just means a state develops, and that's just human nature. You can look at countries where, you know, they refer to them as failed states. I forget the name of one in Africa, which is where all the, for hundreds of years, I mean, one of the first wars that the United States fought was a war against pirates on, I think it was the Barbary Coast. And they kept saying that there's no government there. There's just no government. And I think that's an incorrect statement to say that there's no government. There's no government that we recognize as being a legitimate government, but a government definitely exists. And if you have a group of people, if you don't control that, you end up having really bad people end up controlling government, regardless of what it develops into. An example would be that, let's just say on your street, there's you and maybe just you and your family. That's it. That's all it is you and your family in an area. If you were to be attacked by somebody from another region, I would assume that you would defend your home and your family. Would that be a fair statement?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So in that definition, in Sun Tzu, are you familiar with Sun Tzu, The Art of War, and kind of that mythology?
It's been a long time since I've read most of it, but I'm familiar. Yeah. Yeah. I've read a lot of it.
It's really fascinating, because just you coordinating and defending with your family, it meets the definition of a state. It's a group of people trying to preserve themselves. And
That's not the definition of a state, though. Definition of a state is, are people who are politically united under a government in a certain territory.
Well, that is one definition of a state for sure. In Texas v. White, they gave several definitions of a state. And the key, I'm going to come back to that, because...
Just hold on a second. We're talking over Cliff Burton, which is a heresy on the show. But we're up against the break. My name is Mark Stevens. Talking with Corey from Agenda 31. We'll be back with what is not a state, and if there's proof of any, when we get back in just a moment. Don't go away. Welcome back to the No State Project. We're here live most Saturdays from 4 to 7 Eastern Standard Time on the Liberty Radio Network, LRN.FM, coming to you live today, of course, from the Fortified Compound in Mesa, Arizona for October 15, 2016. We will also be live next week, so if we cannot get to your call today, don't hesitate to call early for the show next week on October 22nd. And keep in mind, we're going to be doing a live stream, hopefully within 2 weeks. We'll do a regular live stream of the No State Project on YouTube Wednesday afternoon, so late Wednesday afternoon. Check markstevens.net for an actual time. And I'll have an actual time set that I'll put on the website when we get closer to an air date. So I want to bring back Corey with Agenda 31, talking about why there may actually be states. But, you know, I just want to point out, though, Corey.
Yeah.
When I'm talking about it, I'm clear about the definition that I'm using, because that's why I talk about you have to show that there's a state, you know, citizens, a state, and a government, and that their constitutional laws apply to anybody.
Oh, fantastic. I've missed that then, Mark. Would you just quickly give me your definition of a state? That might completely change my perspective on this.
I did earlier. I'll say it.
Sure.
It's citizens politically organized under a government occupying a certain territory.
Okay. That sounds very much like the definition that the court gave in the Texas v. White case, where they found in favor of a state and in against the federal government, which is a really fascinating case. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not.
That's what I was actually quoting.
Oh, perfect. Okay.
That's actually my go-to quote. So in an article I did last year about that, I quoted from Ballantyne's Law Dictionary, but I included in the quote that it was that Texas case that the Supreme Court was ruling on. So that's why it sounds familiar.
Yeah, and what's fascinating about that case, which kind of brings me to my point, is the state that they ruled in favor of, for all intents and purposes at that point, it functionally did not exist. There was nobody holding office in that state. There were no employees that were members of the political organization of the state that the government found in favor of. And that's because Texas had lost the Civil War, and the state at the time was occupied by federal officers. And so I think that's a really important thing that a lot of people don't quite understand, is that at the time, basically, the government was saying to the gentleman who invested in the bonds there that, hey, sorry, your state's gone. That it's over. We're a new state, and you don't get your money back. And the federal judiciary said, the state that he is claiming to be a citizen of and where he wants his money back from, that state's guaranteed to exist in perpetuity. So that definitely changes my perspective on what I'm trying to achieve, which is an alignment of efforts, and from there. So basically, what I was getting at with a state is that anytime you have a group of people, a system of government evolves, whether it's an evil system of government, whether it's a totalitarian system, a warlord, a monarchy, a republic, some sort of system of government begins to evolve whenever you have a group of people living together. And what I would propose is that in addition to the legal arguments that you have given as far as the No State Project being, hey, get out of my life, is to perhaps embrace the same idea of Texas v. White, that potentially the people that you're dealing with on a state level in Arizona, they're not from Arizona. They source their authority from the District of Columbia, and they're imposing, through your voluntary consent, they're imposing their laws upon you. That's a pretty big statement, right? Your voluntary consent?
Yeah, you've probably got most of the people in the audience
pissed off
at this point.
Well, that's not what I'm trying to do, and I really do mean to bring just basic information, like just facts. That's it. And I understand that that this can be disconcerting, but let me first explain where I get this, some evidence to show that perhaps things are different than what these people who are coming in with all their codes and what they're doing to literally trick you into a form of consent that you're not aware of, based on the way the government operates at the federal level. In fact, how about if I send you on Skype, I'm going to text you just a link real quick. And this is to the United States Code, but it's from the House of Representatives. And if you go to Chapter 4, did you get that and open it up?
I'm sorry, did I get what? Chapter 4?
Oh, I sent you a link to United States Code on Skype in the chat. And it'll just take you right to, should take you right to the United States Code, Chapter 4, entitled The States.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
Okay. And if you go to Section 112, it references compacts between the states. But if you just look at Section B, it kind of gives you a definition that's a little bit different than what I deduce from this that Alaska and Hawaii are not the several states, because they're excluded from the several states. That's one thing.
It says the term states means the several states and Alaska, Hawaii.
Yeah. So the difference is the several states, they enter the union via an act of Congress. Alaska and Hawaii did not. They entered the union through presidential executive authority under the 14th Amendment. Not only that, but within each of the several states through the 14th Amendment, they've created another state, but that state exists literally in Washington, D.C. So one of the things I'll show you is just right where we were talking, and this is the same way with every single state. I'm going to send you a link to Arizona code right now that, again, just search. It's number 38 at the bottom of the page, and it gives you the definition of a state. Now, this is at the state level, and it uses a very very tricky kind of wordplay here. And it basically says state means a state of the United States, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands, and any territory or insular possession subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Now, the term state of the United States is not the same as the several states.
But this is being used in a state level for a particular section.
Correct. And for a particular section, you're absolutely right. The second portion, I'll send you. Are you familiar with the Arizona code for commercial activities and defining the location of a debtor?
You know, that's kind of stuff that I haven't gotten into in over 10 or 12 years.
Well, so. The Arizona commercial code basically just says the United States is located in the District of Columbia. And the code, for the entire code, same thing with California, every single code has this. Texas, all of them are the same way. And you can go back to the Civil War as to why all of this happened. They're basically saying the United States is located, I mean, it says it straight up, the United States is located in the District of Columbia. And the state of California, as defined by the same way that it's defined in Arizona, that state is literally located at 444 North Capitol Way Northwest in Washington, D.C. And it's the type of state that was also referenced in Texas v. White, which was not a state that had a defined territory. It's a state that is not one of the states that's guaranteed a Republican form of government. In fact,
Hold on, we're up against a break, right. So just hold tight. Keep that thought. My name is Mark Stevens, talking with Corey with Agenda 31. We'll be back here on the No State Project in just a few moments. Don't go away. Welcome back. Listening to the No State Project here on LRN.FM, the Liberty Radio Network. And why would someone tell me not to talk with a New York accent? I don't have an accent. I'm from Long Island. This is the way I normally talk. I didn't think, especially if the show was broadcasting in the Northeast, that would be a problem. But, it comes and goes, you know. We're talking with Corey with Agenda 31. And we got a lot to get through here, Corey, but... I want you to finish what you were saying before we went to the break.
The reason I bring those codes that I referenced is because it supports your claim that why would they have jurisdiction over you just because you happen to be located in a certain county? Their authority, all these people that are bringing these challenges, whether it's code enforcement, traffic tickets, everything, it appears to me that their authority is sourced from the District of Columbia, and that the District of Columbia has its own citizens via the 14th Amendment. And those citizens are citizens of the District of Columbia by voluntary consent. That's the part that seems to get people really pissed off at me when I bring up the whole thing of voluntary consent. And I think you and I might disagree, because I heard you earlier on the show say that you have to have a driver's license. That I disagree with. I don't think you have to have a driver's license, and I think there's a ton of evidence to show, both court cases and so forth, that a driver's license is not necessary. But have you ever examined the application for a driver's license in Arizona?
It's been quite a while, but you know in practice, and this is played out every day, no matter where you are. I'm not talking just anecdotally from my own personal experience. I deal with quite a few people, And most of the people who contact me are doing so because of traffic.
Oh, of course. Yeah. And I got rid of my driver's license in 2010. And I can 100% guarantee you not having a driver's license is an incredibly difficult endeavor.
Oh,
I mean,
I know. In fact, the judge wanted to know why the fire department was at one of my stops. And I had to tell him because these animals were going to set my car on fire. That's why. Because in practice, if you don't have the, there may be, not that I'm familiar with, let's just say for sake of argument, that people like these, like the predators of the Franchise Tax Board, are right. There's nothing in the law that says you have to do A, B, or C. In practice, if you don't, you will severely be, you will be severely punished. I know from personal experience. I've been, I've gone to Joe Arpaio's gulag on the Madison Street Jail. I've been there a couple times. I know. So in practice, whatever the law may or may not say, practice is overwhelming evidence that it's compulsory.
Of course, yeah. I agree 100%. And I would say that everybody in government, they, especially at the state level, they believe you have to have a license. The only place that I've found in modern, you know, within the last few years where there's been any commentary, there's not been a direct case on it, but any commentary regarding a license was 7 or 8 months ago in the Supreme Court. And there are some anecdotal evidence that, you know, people abandoned the type of citizenship that prevailed in that case of Texas v. White, even though that state no longer existed. The citizenship guaranteed to the people prevailed, and that the voluntary adoption of being a 14th Amendment citizen is a real problem. And one example of that, I mean, we can call it compulsory, and in practice, I mean, I've had cars taken away. I've gone through several prosecutions. I'm in the middle of a prosecution right now with not having a license. So you and I 100% agree that practically having a driver's license is very necessary. The problem with a driver's license is that application, at least in California, I'm not familiar with the Arizona application, but in California, the application, there's a portion of it where it states my presence in the United States is authorized under federal law. And you have to sign that as one of the certifications that are under penalty of perjury. In Colorado, another example is that you have to, when you purchase a car, you have to sign a document that says you will be using the car for commercial purposes. Otherwise, they won't register it.
So, does it actually say you're using it for commercial purposes?
Yeah, I haven't seen the form. A fan of our show actually contacted my co-host and went to go buy a car. And that was one of the things that he was required to sign. And from listening to our show, he was aware of, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense because most people just go through and sign all this stuff. Another woman who was wanted to kind of debunk my theory as far as dealing with the DMV and whether or not you have to turn over ownership to the DMV of your car, which I think I can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that you do when you register it, then what she did was she purchased a truck, and she purchased it in the state next to hers, which was, I believe it was Illinois. It was Illinois and Iowa, these two states that are involved, and I forgot where she was at. But they gave her the what's called the MCO, the Manufacturer's Certificate of Origin. That's like the birth certificate for the truck that she bought. And she tried to register the car without giving that without that form, and just take it in and register it with the DMV, and they would not register it. And
okay, was she the outright owner of it, or did she have a loan on it?
She was the outright owner of it. If you have a loan on it, then they won't give you the MCO because that'll go to the bank. So she was the outright owner of it. She actually works in government, in local government, and it went so long that, you know, she could no longer drive her truck to work anymore because it became obvious that there's no plates on it, you know, no registration, and here she works for government. So she ended up relenting, and my understanding is she turned in the MCO and got the registration. But prior to that, they would not give any registration.
But bottom line, I mean, this is something I wrote about in Adventures. Whether you have the MCO or not, whether you have a low deal title to, you know, a piece of property, you know, or it doesn't matter because they're taxing it, and in their mind, in the way they do things, in a practical sense, as well as their laws, are all both consistent. You don't own it to begin with. All you are is a user. I mean, that's right from their own mouth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely it. That's the case.
But I want to get back to this because there's so much to go through here. Because, for one, it does say in Section K, this section applies only for the purposes of this article. So the reason why I think they're saying here that the seat of government and where you would sue the United States government, they're saying, would be in the District of Columbia. Not that the United States government as a corporate body is only located in the District of Columbia. But we got to go through this thing about the voluntary compliance thing because – so far, I think you're losing that argument.
All right, so let's go back. Take a example of someone who is born. Like, and there's a recent case in Texas where a girl was born into a family who they don't get social security numbers, they don't get birth records, they don't do anything to associate themselves with government, and so there's a group of people who kind of live in a very closed society. And the girl wanted to go out and be a part of the world. She wanted to go to college. She wanted to do all these other things. And the schools and all the different things that she wanted to participate in said, you have to have a social security number.
Right.
So, and this kind of goes back, this kind of tough for a lot of people to recognize, but at the federal level, the common laws of England, that's the law. That it's the common laws of England as abrogated by the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. But some of the basics are still there. So back in, actually not that long ago, less than 150 years ago, it was very common for people to be under specialty contract in the service to someone else. And if you were under specialty contract, that meant that you were like a servant of some sort. You worked out some sort of an arrangement. And that arrangement had to be voluntary. That is what I would say has led to the idea of birth records. Because if you want to get a driver's license, you can't use an identification that's perfectly acceptable under the common laws of England. You have to use a different form of identification. And to begin with, you have to go to a state office, get a copy, not the original, because they own the original, get a copy of a state-issued birth record or some other form of identification that sources its authority from the District of Columbia, the agency that created that document and owns it, their authority is from the District of Columbia, then you take that document, at least in California, I'm not familiar with Arizona, but in California, there's another certification that you have to say, I am this person. And if you look carefully of how a birth record is constructed, it's constructed in such a way that you cannot possibly be a citizen of one of the several states because the several states operate under a different form of government that's very foreign to us.
Well, that's something that hasn't been established yet with evidence. So we'll get to that when we get back on the other side of the break. We'll be back in just a moment. Don't go away. Welcome back to the No State Project. We're in the third of 3 hours of Anarchy Radio here on the Liberty Radio Network, where, of course, it always goes so fast. That's the thing. You tend to stick to principles and ethics and keep things rational, and the time just gets away from you. But I want to welcome back. We're talking with Corey from Agenda 31 Radio. And we only have the one segment. I'm sorry. We'll have to have you come back and maybe flesh this out more. But let me just jump in here and give you my perspective on this since we don't have that much time.
Fantastic.
Even if we accept as true what you're saying about the states just all being in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And start using all this legal interpretation. Legal interpretation is an issue of discretion, though, where the judge can disagree with you and survive appeal, even though he's wrong, because it has to shock the conscience. It has to be so absolutely wrong. And what it does, too, when you agree that it's completely irrelevant to discuss what the statutes say until they've established evidence that the Constitution and Code apply in the first place.
Well, the way, if they have your name, if they come out and they look for your name in the computer and your name comes up, that, I contend, is evidence that you consented at some point to be a part of that system and then subject yourself to the laws of the United States, the administrative jurisdiction of the United States. That when you compare that to people who live what is obviously a difficult life at this point, but it is the way the framers set up the country, is that the average citizen would have no connection with government. And instead, through, you know, trick language and very severe damage to the country through the Civil War, those states that were to protect those rights of citizens, like the Texas, which was the case in Texas v. White, those states no longer function. They only exist on paper. And that's through the voluntary abandonment. I use the term voluntary, recognizing that these assholes, well, I won't cuss, sorry, these people that come in and impose their will and create a situation where you'll lose your car, you'll be put in jail, and all these different things that'll happen if you don't get a license, it, to me, just demonstrates the type of fight we're up against.
Yeah, but it's not historically accurate to say that the way the original predators, called the framers, set things up, that there was going to be no contact with the federal government. They were citizens of the national government, and contact with that government came in, was regular depending on where you were. Because let's say you didn't have any direct, you didn't have an income tax, but you still had federal taxes. So you still had imposts and tariffs and things like that that the you know, somebody in Georgia would come in contact with. So it's really not historically accurate to say that there was not supposed to be any contact with the federal government. There's always been contact. There's just more of it now. And yeah. But what specific facts are you relying on to show that people freely agreed to interact with these people called government, like freely agreeing to get a driver's license or a social security number or pay taxes? I mean,
I'm using their definition. I agree with you that the coercion involved in forcing you to get those things is not moral. They do not have the legal high ground for it. But the way the laws work at the federal level are very different. And comparing that to people who don't have those documents, never had them, there is a very big difference. Those people have the type of interaction that is certainly much more agreeable to me personally with federal officials than it does someone who, when a federal official of any type, whether it's your local code enforcement officer, because all of these people work for an agency that has a federal employer identification number, every single one of them. And as far as there being citizens of the national government, I would say that's an area where we disagree, and maybe in the future I can provide you some references where the courts recognize there was no such thing as a citizen of the United States, even though commonly it was referred to prior to the 14th Amendment. Technically, there was no such thing, and that it was state citizenship that prior to the 14th Amendment that everybody had. You had either you were a citizen of Virginia, a citizen of Arizona, or a citizen of whatever state you were in. Obviously, Arizona came to play later. But when the 14th Amendment happened, that's where it gets very confusing, because Washington, D.C., although the federal government, the seat of government, is located in the District of Columbia, the reason why the District of Columbia was created the way it was is interesting and helpful to look at, but also the way that that authority exists within every state is also a very critical factor in this. And that once the 14th Amendment has occurred, once that was passed, it gave the federal government the ability to have its own citizens where it could rule its own citizens, and it does in a very just perverted way. And it does it through intimidation. It does it through forcing people to believe that you have to have a driver's license, and then imposing these crazy, you know, penalties for not having one. But that's fairly recent. There are plenty of decisions that when these regulatory schemes were first coming about that people won not having to have a driver's license, not having to register their car. But the status of those people were quite different, because not everyone had a Social Security number in 1930. In fact, very few people
had a Social Security number in 1930. It wasn't until 1935. If you look, and I wrote about this recently that when you look at those cases where people didn't have a driver's license or registration, you have to look at the date, because at one time it was that way, but it's all been changed. Now, you can discuss the, you know, how insidious it is to impose a privilege tax on somebody when a privilege tax has historically been defined as a business tax. I get that. But those cases that dealt with that are out of date, because the legislatures, all of them, converted a state right to travel, which they can do, into a taxable privilege so that they can pay for the regulation of the police power. So it wasn't ever, that I've ever read, that the status of them were different. It was because at the time, the legislatures hadn't gotten around to actually taxing and requiring a license for everybody. And that's why you have separate applications. You don't fill out the same application and get the same license for if you're going to be a hack or, you know, a cabbie or something. It's a different license than what someone, you know, who's not a cabbie would get. You cannot drive a cab with an operator's license. You'll go to jail.
Agreed. I totally agree. But one thing those licenses all have in common is that they give you the license, the privilege to drive a motor vehicle. And there's definitely a difference between vehicle and motor vehicle. At the federal level, the difference is wide open, very, very clear. One is defined in Title I. The other one is defined in Title 18, motor vehicle being in Title 18 and vehicle being in Title I. At the state level, at least in California, those two definitions are virtually the same. If you read through the definition of vehicle versus the definition of motor vehicle, they're basically describing the same thing, yet you can only register a motor vehicle. A vehicle is what has been held as being private personal property that is household goods, not a motor vehicle. And by a, you know, I know we're almost out of time, but through all of these different things that I've brought up today, what they've been able to do is put a U.S. citizen, who's not an Article IV citizen, but a U.S. citizen under the 14th Amendment, in a position where they no longer have the ability to own a vehicle. Their political status prevents them from even owning a vehicle. Whatever they have, it's considered a motor vehicle, regardless of what the use is for. So
we're out of time, but none of this still proves that anything is voluntary, because we know in practice it's not. And even under their own code, you do this or it's a crime. So even their own laws set forth that it is, so it's not voluntary. But bottom line, I don't see why it would be effective to use that instead of challenging them on the claims that they're actually making.
Well, I think it would be effective to combine the challenges, not either or, but that both the way that you have gone about questioning them through the Socratic method, which I think is fantastic, is obviously very effective. You've had wins. But then taking it to the next level is being able to address this in higher courts. And that's where this other form of citizenship, and there are plenty of things to prove that this other state exists. And one of them I like to use is the mail. You can send mail through the jurisdiction of the other state that I'm referring to, and the postage rates are very different. It runs off the rates set by the 37th Congress, not what you have to pay today. And for you and I, that's a really good deal, because we can pay that postage using worthless Federal Reserve notes, but the several states, they have to pay for it in gold and silver. If you take a silver dollar today, it works out to be roughly, what, $22, something like that. A postage stamp under the 37th Congress, the rate of postage, works out to be about 46 cents to mail a letter.
Yeah, well, and we are off air now, but I just want to see. The reason why I have a real problem with it is because you're going based on the presumption that there was a legitimate government to begin with, and that's demonstrably false.
Well, I think more what I'm looking to do is to use the government's own, whether you want to call it legitimate or not. I mean, you use the, what is it, is it not Birchfield, it's Brady. You use the Brady decision quite a bit. And that the authority for that decision came from the same government. So you're using their own tools to your own advantage in a case that works.
The difference is that's not legal interpretation. When I use Brady, I'm not really getting into this area of statutory construction, which in my experience is almost always, if not always, a losing proposition for us because they have discretion and they will exercise it to rule against you. And trying to overcome an abuse of discretion doesn't work out too well for us. It's one of the highest legal standards, and that's why I don't do it. So when I do make a due process claim, I have my evidence to show where I have admissions from the cop, from the judge, I have things from the prosecutor. It's not a matter of my interpretation of the code or the way I read the code is more correct than the way you read it. And it's just been my experience that, and from what I've read and what other people have reported to me, if you go down the road of statutory construction, it doesn't matter if you're right. They don't care, and they'll rule against you, and the burden of getting it overturned is pretty much insurmountable.
And we agree on that. The what I would reference is people who have never entered the system and then their interactions with government. Now, the question would be, once somebody who has entered the system, like me, I had a driver's license, social security number, I've done everything I can to notify those people that I withdraw consent from it, but that doesn't matter. They just continue to operate as if they have complete control. The $2 question would be, how do you compel them to treat you the same way as somebody who has never consented? And that's yet to be determined.
Yeah, people. I have to get someone else on.
Yeah,
but you can have people from Canada that have had no interaction with the United States government. If they walk over that border, they're going to be treated as if the laws do apply to them, and it's not going to make a difference to them. So again, even if there's a loophole that we're not familiar with, in practice and in their heads, it makes no difference.
Well, somebody from Canada who comes across the border, the laws would apply to them, just the way the law of nations work. But somebody who's born in the jurisdiction of one of the several states and then never avails themselves of citizenship in the United States, they have a very different standing. So that's something I think would be worth it to explore as far as how those people who are actually born here, when they have interactions with government, what happens. And there's quite a bit of anecdotal evidence that suggests it is possible. I certainly don't have the absolute answer for it. I'm working on it. But it is possible because there are people who have been born that don't have social security numbers, don't have birth certificates, things like that. And the government seems to leave them alone for the most part. I'm not aware of anyone being prosecuted in modern times for not having a driver's license who was born here and then never got one and never got a social security number.
Just because they haven't been prosecuted, and if it's saying that there are people that are in a situation like that, just because they haven't been prosecuted yet doesn't mean that they won't and
correct.
That they won't treat any different. So I got to bring some other people on. We'll flesh it, but like we said off air, and it will be available for the podcast, because thanks to Calvin. The fundamental flaw, as I see it, I think you said that you agreed, but you see it as more just use their own words against them, is that there was never a legitimate government to begin with. There's no evidence their rules apply. And again, like for those who are listening live, I don't see the benefit of using statutory construction and interpretation when that has proven time and time again to be a loser. It's not that I want to say, well, show me a court case. Like people say to me, show me one judge that's agreed with you. Here, you're really asking a judge to agree with your interpretation of the law. And I don't see that as an effective way of defending against one of their attacks.
I would disagree. I think what it would be to ask a judge to determine whether or not consent has been withdrawn. That's where I'm headed. That case I was referring to that's interesting to listen to, it's called Birchfield versus North Dakota. It's on the Supreme Court's website. And you can listen to the audio, and the justices go into very deeply and kind of confuse the attorney regarding consent and a driver's license. And then another example is Justice Thomas writing in his concurring opinion on the Prince v. United States case regarding the substantive foundation of the Second Amendment, and that it's been a long time since anybody's brought that up. Yet I can show hundreds of court cases that have been brought up regarding the Second Amendment that Justice Thomas is either completely ignoring and pretending like nobody's brought a case up, or maybe it's the American people have kind of forgotten what their roots were and what it meant to be a citizen of one of the states without being a citizen of the United States.
Well, send me a link to that. I'll check now. Sure. I'd have to see some proof that it was effective. And so far, everyone I know that has raised statutory construction that way has not fared too well. So, but oh yeah, so you did that. Well, Corey, the show is Agenda 31, and when can people hear that?
We broadcast on Saturdays, and you can you can always subscribe. It's on agenda31.org, and that's it. I think we're actually of like mind, Mark, on a lot of things, maybe just a little bit difference of opinion on a few, but I really appreciate the time. Thanks for letting me call in.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you on. And if you get some proof that the statutory construction has been effective, I'd be the first to have you on and discuss it.
Fantastic. Well, I'm working on it.
All right. Well, good luck. Let me know what happens.
Thanks a lot. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Corey.
Bye-bye.